Professor Kate Iving from the Clinical Nursing School of Nursing, Psychotherapy and Community Health, Faculty of Science and Health in Dublin City University is here with us. Why am I so privileged? Because I was able to attend one of her seminars that really just changed my whole thought about how to think about brain health. And without further ado, I want to give a great welcome. Welcome to this platform. And we want you to take the stage and tell us about how we as individuals can improve our brain health. Because you've found out a lot of things, and I'll leave it over to you.
Okay. Well, if I may, I'm going to start off by saying, calling out what it is that we think of when we think of brain health. We think of dementia, and that's probably because that's one of the most feared conditions of aging. So, I want to just clarify for all of the listeners that, let's just be honest, we fear this condition that we feel is completely arbitrary, that can just kind of happen, utterly kind of arbitrary process and selection, and totally beyond the control of any individual, that you could just get this thing. And pretty much, I think you're hard pressed now to find anyone in the community who doesn't know somebody or know somebody who is affected, or know somebody who's somebody is affected by dementia. So it is one of the kind of has been kind of, I suppose it's still a little bit taboo, it's still a little bit stigmatized, and people aren't talking about it openly, because it is, talking about dementia involves this kind of dread that we all have of losing our sense of self, of our sense of purpose, or who we are, or our autonomy, or having to go and live in a home, or whatever it is. For different people, the fear kind of manifests or exists differently for different people. But for most people, it is a fear that we have that's associated with aging. And it does feel completely beyond the control of normal individuals. And so I've been a nurse for many years, and I have entirely looked after people with dementia. I guess one of the things I want to say is that when people have dementia, it doesn't seem to be lived in this fearful way. I mean, we fear getting it, but when people actually have dementia, not everybody lives with a poor quality of life. In fact, people can live with a very good quality of life with dementia for a very long time through most of the disease. It's not a painful disease, unless you have another disease alongside it. So it's not inherently painful, but spiritually and psychologically it could be considered painful. And I think, we just need to talk about it more. And one of the things I became really interested in when I was looking after people with dementia is all of their families would come and say, oh, how do I not get this thing? How do I not get dementia? I don't want to get like my father or mother or brother or whoever. And so I started looking into it, and I'd been a nurse for a good 15 years at this point, and I started looking into dementia prevention, thinking, well, you can't prevent dementia, so I don't even know why I'm looking this up. And then I realized in looking it up that you can do a lot to prevent dementia, in fact. Now, a little bit technical, it might be that we're not actually preventing dementia. What we might be doing is delaying its onset. But in a disease of aging, and given that at some point in time we will all die, delaying it by 10 years would effectively eliminate dementia in the population. So it's because the vast majority of people who get dementia are in the last 10 years of their lives. So dementia is something that we fear, because there's no cure and there's no treatments that modify the disease. There are several drugs that work moderately well with some people with Alzheimer's type dementia. So dementia is not a diagnosis, it's a syndrome. And within that kind of umbrella, if you imagine an upturned umbrella that catches all of the different diseases, Alzheimer's is one of the diseases of within the dementias that most people will have heard of. And that's because some fairly high profile people had dementia, like Ronald Reagan, Albert Reynolds, closer to home in Ireland. Some high-profile people have come forward and admitted that they have have or had the disease, and you know, and that's why we've heard more of Alzheimer's, and then also the drugs work better on Alzheimer's, so people are more keen to diagnose that than the other types of dementia. But you may have heard of vascular dementia or Lewy body dementia or frontotemporal dementia. They're all different types of dementia, but it doesn't, regardless of what type of dementia you have, I really want to get this across to people. If you've met one person with dementia, you've just met one person with dementia, because dementia happens to an individual. It doesn't happen to a brain. And this is where what we can do to help ourselves is really, really important. Because if we think of dementia as only something that happens in our brain, then unless we're a brain surgeon, what could you or I and normal mortal people do about dementia? But if dementia is something that happens to an individual, a whole person, the sum of everything that makes them who they are, which it does seem to be, because when you meet someone with dementia, they always present differently. So I've been nursing people with dementia now since I was 21 or something like that, and I've never met two people who present the same. Some people present with really extreme memory problems, and they can wash and dress themselves no problem. They can remember to go to meetings in the future, and they can remember things from the distant past, but they can't remember the near past. For some people it presents more as a functional problem, so they can't remember how to clean their teeth or button up buttons, problems with fine coordination. For some people it's all of the above, and for other people it's personality changes and different changes that can be very distressing for the people around the person and for the person themselves. So dementia presents differently, because when dementia comes to a person, it comes to the whole person, and that means it interacts with that person's personality, the coping skills that they've gained through the whole life, the relationships that they have garnered and invested in through their lives. And all of these things mean that it affects somebody different. When I go to see people, say in their own homes, where somebody has a dementia, I'm always shocked that sometimes the relatives go, "Oh yeah, it came out of the blue." And I'm looking at the person with the memory problems going, "How could that have come out of the blue? It's really obvious, really extreme memory problems." Oh, wow. But the family have seamlessly supported the person for such a long time that nobody's really noticed that there's memory problems. So that's part of that person's coping skills. That's how, you know, they've invested in those relationships enough that those people care enough to support that person in a really seamless way. And that can happen for a really long time for some people. And for other people, their personalities are so anxious that the first little memory problem, they arrive in a clinic and say, "I think I'm getting dementia," when it's not even dementia. So all memory problems interact with an actual personality really, really differently. And that person has a set of coping skills. That person has, you know, some people use humour really, really well to offset memory problems and make them to be not such an issue. So anyway, get to the point, Kate. How do we prevent it? So it is a lot in our control. And when I started researching how we can prevent dementia so that I could tell the relatives of the people I was caring for with dementia what they might do to not get into that high-risk category, I realised that if we did certain things, we could definitely delay the onset of the dementia. So if it is a lot to do with our genes. Probably some people say 60% to do with our genes, some people say 40% to do with our genetic makeup, and we can't do an awful lot about that because they're the genes we inherited from our parents when we were born, and they do change throughout life, but probably, you know, more or less they're stable. So we have a genetic makeup, and that gives us a predisposition to whether or not we will have, you know, be likely to get dementia or likely to not get dementia. So we inherit those genes, and we inherit a risk of dementia. That's all. We don't inherit dementia. So it's not one of those diseases where if you're mother or father has it and their father had it and their father had it, necessarily you will, because it depends at least half of what, well, let's say at least 40% of our risk of dementia is made up of lifestyle factors. Lifestyle factors that are entirely within our control to a large extent. And this is what I found really, really interesting. Now, of course, I'm about to tell you what they are. And of course, you're all going to probably roll your eyes and go, ah, sure, Kate, it's all the boring stuff. And it is the boring stuff and the stuff you already know about preventing cancer and about preventing heart disease and stroke and all of the other diseases, the chronic diseases, you know, diseases of aging. You know, they're good for dementia as well. So so we do have to stop smoking and we do have to drink less and we do have to watch our cholesterol and blood pressure, make sure we're not overweight, do plenty of exercise. Think of some of the things you can do are like shields. So eating a healthy diet and exercising is a shield. You know, it kind of protects you. And then there's things you can actually really do, like doing a load of cognitive exercise, that kind of thing. You could even think of that as like more of a sword to go against dementia. But largely anyway, there's a lot that we can do in terms of right through the lifespan, actually. So there's emerging research about breastfeeding and late life dementia risk, although that research is very early. Obviously, we have to follow people for a very long time if we want to follow them from when they were breastfed. So the factors are high cognitive activity, and that would have its best window with people up to about the age of 21. So staying in school or college or just staying learning, whatever you're doing, keeping an active brain, that's really, really important. There's a lovely study called the London Taxi Drivers versus London Buses study. And what they did was, it happened in the 60s, and they took a load of... Now, in London, taxi drivers have what you call the knowledge. They have to be tested on every road and byway in London, and they have to have a memory of all of the names, and they're tested on this. And they don't get their taxi license unless they have the knowledge. They pass the knowledge test. So they have a really big knowledge of different routes, and taxi drivers have other skills that are really good for cognitive activity. So taxi drivers don't choose who gets in their taxi, so they have people of different cultures in their taxi, they have different people who speak different languages, they have people who are young, people who are old, people from different social groups. And so those taxi drivers are constantly changing what we would call cognitive frames. So like, if you imagine you're talking to a four-year-old or you're talking to a 64-year-old, you don't talk exactly the same. You change your cognitive frame, the way you say things. And taxi drivers are constantly having to do this. They have to change. They have to be looking out for danger. They have to be seeing who might be safe, who might be, you know, they're constantly assessing things. And then they have to know the routes. Then if the route is blocked for some reason, roadworks or traffic or whatever, they have to know an alternative route. So they have to be very mentally flexible. On the other hand, the London bus drivers very rarely ever talk to their customers, just to say thank you when they were getting off.
Oh my gosh,
they sat still in the bus. They never got out. So they were really, really low activity. And they didn't have to change cognitive frames because they were just sent on the same routes every single time, not like the taxi drivers who had to talk to people and who had to change routes and who had to be really aware of what was going on. So they followed a group of London taxi drivers and London bus drivers and found that the London taxi drivers rarely ever converted to getting dementia in old age, but the bus drivers had a much higher conversion. So that's just to say that, you know, the more we use our brains, the more we change. It's not just about doing the crossword or doing the Sudoku. It's about being engaged in the world, about, you know, learning and continuing to learn. And that's really good for us as human beings, but it also is really good at preventing dementia. And just to finish the story of the bus drivers, they then looked at, in the 60s in London, they had bus conductors. So they compared the conductors with the bus drivers and found that the conductors did much better. And they thought that was because they do a lot more talking with the customers, and also they're up and down the stairs and they're active. So that brings me to my second point, which is staying physically active. which doesn't necessarily mean that you have to run off and get a gym membership and work out in the gym. But it does mean being active, taking the stairs instead of taking the elevator, walking and getting off the bus a couple of stops early and walking a bit further, making sure you get your steps in for the day for anyone who has a pedometer. But it's just being active. So if you think about the bus conductors, they probably weren't, you know, as a culture, particularly fit and active people, but they were constantly on their feet and moving around. And it's that activity that seems to be really good rather than full-on exercise. In fact, we don't know that much about whether doing full-on exercise really helps against brain health, because unfortunately a lot of the people, like professional footballers who do a lot of exercise, often also have head injuries from heading the ball and concussion and that kind of thing. So it's difficult to know, because that's a risk factor for getting late life dementia. So high cognitive activity, high activity levels, physical activity levels, a healthy diet, and I'd say a Mediterranean diet or a rainbow diet, so as many colours as you can eat in one day. And as I always say, my children think that means a packet of Skittles in the door. But it's not a packet of Skittles, obviously. It's like tomatoes and broccoli and, as many colours as you can eat in one day. Then you're going to be hitting those micronutrients. It's a rule of thumb, but it's a pretty good rule of thumb to make sure you get a Mediterranean diet. But some Mediterranean diets are high in fish. They're all quite low in meat and high in veg and legumes like lentils and beans and that kind of thing. So with the diet and the exercise come the really, really low hanging fruit, and that's midlife high blood pressure. So if you're doing good exercise and you're doing you're eating a good diet and you're watching your stress, then you probably won't have midlife high blood pressure. But that's something you can't know. You can't just be sitting there in your house going, oh, I might have high blood pressure. You could have sky high blood pressure and not know. And in fact, when we were doing the study that led to this these findings, we brought people in from the community and said, can we test your blood pressure? And three of them had such high blood pressure we had to call an ambulance because their blood pressure was dangerously high, and we just had a protocol that if it was so high we had to call an ambulance, and they had to go to the hospital because their blood pressure was so dangerously high, and they didn't have any symptoms. So you can't know your blood pressure just by sitting in a chair. Some people have headaches when they have high blood pressure, but that's not. But if it's been high for a long time, and if it's been getting high over a really prolonged period of time, you would not know that you have high blood pressure. So knowing your numbers is a really important thing. Knowing what your blood pressure is and knowing what your cholesterol is, they're really, really important things. They're so treatable, these conditions now. The drugs that GPs use to treat high blood pressure and high cholesterol cost very, very little, and can be, so easily prescribed. And those two conditions are so easily diagnosed. It's a blood test for cholesterol and, a cuff around your arm and pumps up tight, but it's not very painful. And, these are things that should be done routinely, and we should be asking our GPs, can you check my blood pressure? If it's not been done for a while, we should all know our numbers and know what those figures are, because they lead a lot to reducing our risk of late life dementia. And one of the gerontologists I've friendly with in St James's would say that if we were to just solve the midlife blood pressure problem, we would probably halve the number of people that actually experience dementia just by delaying it for 10 years. And I know lots of people, I just seem to chat to taxi drivers a lot, and I know taxi drivers sit there and never go to the doctor, I'm not going to the doctor. But really, honestly, it's not a painful thing. It doesn't mean you're weak if you go and have your blood pressure tested. But knowing what it is and being brave enough to face up to it if it's high and take the medication, that is so, so important for people to hear and to know that that's important. So where am I up to? Physical activity, I've done cholesterol, smoking, that's a big risk factor. And obviously smoking causes high blood pressure, smoking also causes high cholesterol. And if you smoke, you're probably unlikely to be very physically active because it makes you sedentary because you're breathing problems. So smoking's a really big risk factor. And then the ones that are a little bit less, that are risk factors but a little bit less reversible by us, and one of those would be depression or mood problems. So yeah, I'm a mental health nurse and I would never sit here and say depression is preventable or prevention or even is reversible, because you know, a lot of the studies show that people who suffer with depression suffer cyclically through that throughout their whole lives. And, you know, we do have drugs that can treat some depression, and some people have reactive depression in response to a life trauma, and some of the medication for that can be really effective. But the bottom line is there's a lot of people out there who are suffering with depression and other mood problems, and they don't seek help. And, you know, we are getting better. I think the message is getting out there about talking to somebody if you're suffering with mental health problems. But I really only can add to that message that it is just so important to talk to somebody, a friend, a help group, whoever it is for you that you think you could talk to. Just have that first conversation. If you're listening to me thinking, that's me, I feel depressed, I don't feel like getting up in the morning, I feel like there's no point to life, have that conversation with somebody, whoever it may be, and that's the first step towards actually addressing these mood problems. And then there's the trio of diabetes, heart disease and chronic kidney disease, and they are all risk factors for dementia. But if you manage them really, really well, that can be reduced. So there's nothing, none of those things are particularly reversible as such. But if you manage them really, really well, then they don't have to be a major risk factor for dementia. But if you have diabetes and you're constantly letting your sugars go high and low and all over the place, then that's not going to be good for your long-term dementia risk. And since we finished this study, hearing loss and head injury have emerged as other really salient risk factors. Recurrent head injuries such that happens to boxers as I said, professional football players, rugby players. We know that head injury seems to be a significant risk factor. And then hearing loss in later life also seems to be a significant factor. So again, it's very correctable. Hearing aids are getting better. I know a lot of my patients would say they hate the hearing aids. They'd rather be deaf because they whistle all the time. But they're getting a lot better. And, being able to hear is a really big part of interacting in the world that most of us live in. And so therefore, it helps you to interact and have that cognitive activity and that sense of community and connectedness that really helps. And I suppose then, you know, it is really important, like we're part of communities, we're interconnected, and you know, we can't actually at the moment cure dementia, and we can't 100% prevent it, so we can put ourselves in the group of people who are low risk for developing dementia. And if you ask me where I want to be, I don't want to be in the high risk group. I want to be in the low risk group. But at the same time, I understand, you know, I look after my mum and she has advanced dementia. I looked after my granddad with dementia. There is a good possibility I've inherited the risk, and I'm doing everything I can. I'm taking my own medicine, Mary. I'm looking after my cholesterol, my blood pressure. I'm, you know, doing exercise. I'm doing everything I should. So I don't want to get it, even though I know about it. And I don't think it's the worst disease in the world. But at the same time, I don't want to get it. So I'm doing what I can to prevent it and all of the other things that can happen to you if you don't, like cancer and heart disease and all of the rest of them. So, yeah, but at the end of the day, some of us will develop dementia and we have no cure and no disease modifying medication at the moment. And then what we need is our families around us to keep us well, to be that seamless support around us, that knit around and help us be stay a part of a community. And people often say, oh, your mum's so lucky to have you because you look after her. And I say to them, well, I was really lucky to have her. And that's why I do what I do, because she invested in me and now I invest in her. And I think, you know, oftentimes psychologists talk about cognitive reserve, which is like if you do loads of cognitive activity, like the taxi drivers, then it protects you. It's a protection. You've got a reserve, like a bank vault that you can dig into if other parts of your brain get damaged. But I think about relationship reserve. So I'm really working hard on my children to make sure that if I ever do get dementia, they want to be around me. Well, I don't know. I've said to them I don't want them to look after me, but I'm not afraid of dementia. I'm afraid of being lonely because I love chatting to people. So I don't want to be lonely if I get dementia, but I think I'll probably be okay if I'm with people who are nice to me. So I've said, no, you can put me in a nursing home, but make sure it's a nice one. And come and see me because I don't want to be lonely. But that's me. You know, other people's, their fear of dementia is a different type of fear. For me, it would be a fear of loneliness. But for other people, it's a fear of loss of independence or other things. But it doesn't matter why we might not want to get dementia. What really matters is that if we do get it, there would be people around who would see us as a human being who is worthy of status, of personhood, you know, as somebody who's worthy of respect and positive regard, even if the person we are is very different from the person we used to be. So hopefully that's said everything that needs to be said about dementia prevention and brain health.
I think that's just amazing, the fact that you not only come from it from a research point of view, you also have the experience with your own mom and your own grandfather, and you've been able to understand clinically what we need to do. And I just wanted to ask one question. It's about the footballers and the rugby players. What can young people do, because they engage in these sports? How can they prevent? Otherwise, are they going to sit out of the match?
Well, I think one of the things that is really important, you know, we have playgrounds now that have the softer landings if the children fall off, because particularly small children are particularly vulnerable. They can wear a cycle helmet. That is all. I see so many people without cycle helmets. That is just crazy business, because, you know, a head injury is a really big risk factor for late life cognitive impairments, but not to mention in life brain trauma. There are decisions. I mean, rugby is being changed, the scrum's changed to try and make it safer. There are changes happening in sport. The football, the weight of the football has changed incredibly since my granddad was a footballer back in the 1930s. He was a semi-professional footballer and would have been heading the ball all the time, the big heavy leather ball.
Yeah.
So things have changed, you know, but it is a choice that people make whether they do dangerous sports, and it is one that has to be thought about and weighed up, I suppose.
Do you know what, Professor Kate Iving, you have really been thorough with us. You've not spared us. And hopefully this is a wake-up call for many of us hearing again that we can prevent it. There are ways to prevent it. And we have you as an example because you are living with it with your own family. So you haven't just come to give us a whole lot of theory. This is a real thing for you.
Hopefully not too preachy.
No, I think it is that we could all know what to do. And then that is about doing it. Now, how could we get more information? We're coming to very close. So how could we get more information about this? Do you have a website? Can we follow you? Can we come to any of your lectures?
I can give you a website that is really, really good. The Global Brain Health Institute would be the website I might send you to. And then there are other resources on that. And also the Alzheimer's Society is another really good place for support. Get Healthy Ireland. There are loads of websites. I'll give you a selection and you can post them wherever you post.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a real pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you.
Appreciate every minute.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time.